All right, you guys, here we go. So it is Wednesday, 7/28/21, and we are going to be in Isaiah 12 tonight. So we've been through like 11, I think, since you guys were here, right?
Twelve.
Yeah, we're at 12 tonight. So to understand what Isaiah 12 is about, you have to understand what Isaiah 11 is about. And all the way back, obviously, it's like that. It's building on itself each time. But Isaiah 11 was a dramatically messianic chapter. And it talks about the time in the future when there will be peace, there will be no suffering and no killing, and everything will live together and everything will be in peace. Now, there's a couple passages. People come to me and they say, "What about animals in heaven?" Right? Because they usually are dog people. And my wife, for instance, is she gets there and there's no dogs allowed. She's not going in. I'll sit outside the walls. You guys go ahead with your pearly streets, and as long as dogs are allowed out here. But a lot of people are like that. But I say, no. We have multiple passages in the Bible that indicate there's going to be animals. First of all, I don't know where you are in your life concerning animals, but some human beings, I mean, their best friends and their closest companions have been animals. And there's quite a few people that are not going to be very happy and joyful. I don't know how heaven's going to work. Maybe that gets erased. I don't know. Okay. But there's a lot of people that I don't think would be all that joyful without some kind of animals. But we have multiple passages in the Bible that indicate animals. For instance, we just studied last Sunday, Jesus' triumphal return. What's he riding? A horse. There's definitely horses. There's definitely horses. And we've got these descriptions of animals that involve some of the angels, the way they're described. But right here we have this time of peace where the wolf is laying down with the lamb, and the leopard's laying down with the young goat, and all of that. Now, that's strange if you reconcile that with Revelation. Because that time of complete peace and prosperity is after the tribulation, right? So this is complicated, right? But when we studied Revelation, we discovered that the new heaven and new earth exist, that the new heaven, the new Jerusalem comes down and is sitting basically where Jerusalem is. I mean, that's the center of it. It's much bigger. It's the size of like a 1500 mile side cube, basically. It's this gigantic thing. I have no way of knowing what that looks like. I mean, the stars don't exist. Things have changed on the planet dramatically. But it appears that there is some kind of planet like this one that we're still on in some form or fashion, which is interesting to me. Because theologically, if there's this world that's sort of this planet but different, that may well apply to Eden on both ends. The Bible tends to be balanced, and there tends to be something going on both ends. For instance, as we discussed in previous classes, God the Father has a best friend named Moses, who writes five books, including the very first book. And God the Son has a best friend named John, who writes five books, including the last book. The Bible is extremely balanced from end to end. The things that happen in Revelation directly correlate to things that happen in Genesis. Like the whole story makes sense. So if there's a new heaven and a new earth at the end, and Adam and Eve are unusual creations and in that they don't have, they don't have sin, for instance. So they don't have death and disease. They're immortal beings, in the beginning, right? So this is obviously some kind of very special place. Maybe Eden is on Earth, but kind of a different form of Earth, and maybe that's what heaven's like when it comes down the New Jerusalem. Like I said, little out there, but not really that far out there. But the point of it all is, In this time when there is no death or pain or suffering, you have leopards laying down with, you know, lambs and things like that. Nursing child playing at the cobra's hole, etc. Snakes not hurting people. Everything is peaceful. Now, you got two ways of reading that. Okay? And this is just a general overview of what we're in Isaiah, what we're into when it comes to literature. Okay? Two ways of reading that. Way number one is literally, which is how I tend to read the Bible, which, you know, is kind of crazy sometimes, but it's literal. And that means there's literally lions laying down literally with lambs, and there's a place when that's all happening. That would be the earth. It would be the animals there. There's gates. For instance, there's gates on heaven. The only reason you would have gates on heaven is if you could come and go. And it says people come and go, but bad people aren't allowed to come in. And my question is, who's left? I don't know what that looks like, but there very well could be animals still. There could be animals in heaven. Heaven is so large. You know, the New Jerusalem is so large, it can have forests and everything inside of it. We know there's rivers and trees and all kinds of magical, wonderful things happening in there. So, and like Andy said, you know, and I don't know, you guys all probably knew Andy, but you might not have known Andy, the original pastor, older guy, but he said he didn't really want to go to heaven without golf courses. So, you know, there's got to be golf courses for people like Andy. Anyway, it's big enough for all that. It's big enough for billions upon billions of people of all kinds and all kinds of places and everything. So, of course, having animals in there. The other way to read it is as poetry, metaphorical, prophetic poetry, which is completely fine. What would that be in that sense? When I said lions lay down with lambs, what I'm trying to tell you is peace. No violence, no hunting, no killing, peace. That could be a metaphor. It could actually be a lion and a lamb, or it could be a metaphor. We have metaphors all through the Bible. That doesn't mean anything. That doesn't degrade the intensity and the truth of the Bible at all, that there's metaphors there, because you call Jesus a lamb. Jesus isn't an actual lamb. You don't look over there and see a little lamb. He's the lamb because he's the ultimate sacrifice. He's the spotless lamb. He's the whole point of everything. But that's a metaphor, right? So this could be metaphor. So you could read it either way. But if you read it in the way that there actually are lions and ox laying together, then of course that would make a lot of sense. Why would the ark exist? Why would you have, if you went through all the trouble to save all the animals in the first place with the ark, why get rid of them at the end? I don't know. I don't know. But why not have bears and cows grazing together? Why not? But a lot of the stuff that we read in Isaiah is like that. It can be read as completely realistic, or it can be read as metaphor. And that discernment between those two concepts is vital for every person that studies the Bible. It's vital to understand when a metaphorical symbol is being used, when a story, and Jesus loved to tell stories about, you know, mustard seeds and trees growing up and weeds and plants. I mean, all kinds of stories that were metaphors for what he was trying to say. But he's talking about how some of the seeds will land on good soil and grow up strong. That, you know, they're properly nurtured and water. He's talking about Christians, and he's talking about how weeds will try to choke them out. He's talking about the struggles that we go through. All these things are metaphorical, but they're stories and symbols that help us learn things. And so, but you got to figure out where that starts and stops, right? And that's a primary issue in the world of academic or, you know, rhetorical Christianity, the discussions between scholars and leaders. That's a primary point. The ark, the story of the ark, could be completely real or a metaphor, right? The story of Eden could be completely real or a metaphor. Deciding what's what is very hard. We've been dealing with it in the Sunday sermons, a great deal of symbolism, right? The harlot riding the beast and the whole thing. This is symbolism. Now, which parts of it are symbolism, which parts of it aren't? Dragon rises up out of the sea, a great beast. Is that the concept of the Antichrist coming into the world? Or is something coming as a great giant beast? I'm not going to put giant Leviathan dragon rising up out of the ocean past the devil, right? I think that could actually be what it actually looks like. You know, angel comes down, stands on the beach, one leg in the water, one leg in the sand, talking to John, right? Is that a vision, a metaphor, a symbol, or is it an actual angel? I'm pretty convinced that's an actual angel standing in front of John on the beach at Patmos, right? So this is one of the cores of our ability to understand, you know, what we're talking about. Because you could expand that all the way into the end of miracles if you wanted to. You say, oh, the metaphor, the Jesus feeding the 5,000 is a metaphor for his words feeding everyone. There wasn't actual fish or actual bread. And you could make that argument. I think that's extremely dangerous and incorrect. And I think the way in which it's written and the way in which it's presented in the Gospels lets you know it's a true story that's real, right? But you could expand it. So where do you stop? There's got to be a flow. You know, there almost has to be, right? If you want to look at the world and archaeology and everything, a great flood. If you want to talk about theology, that's pretty clear that there's an actual flood. Now, whether the whole world refers to the actual whole world or it refers to the whole world of the Bible, that whole region, you know, Alexander the Great conquered the world. He didn't actually conquer the whole world. He didn't know about America. So it could be the world they're in, or it could be the whole world. And there are stories of floods in China. I don't know. I don't know the whole exact story, but it's extremely dangerous to start shifting everything over to the metaphor column or shifting everything over to the realism column. Because then you're like, did Jesus really kill a fig tree? Is he mad at trees? You know, it's confusing. Is that, you know, what's real and what's not? So we have to be able to discern that. And when we get to something like this, we have the fact that it's poetic the way it's written. We have the fact that we're in a poetic, prophetic book, and it could very well be. But there's certain ways that things are presented where you get the idea that there's some things that are metaphorical and some things that are not, some things that are symbolic and some things are not. There shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse is the first line of 11. Okay, we're in 12 tonight, but I'm just backtracking. So talking about Jesse being a root, talking about a branch, talking about a tree is metaphorical. But that brings us to the concept of a family tree and having a great grandfather and a great grandmother and a grandson and a, you know, uncles. And that's real people. So you're coming to this understanding that metaphor, sometimes symbolic language or sometimes symbolism is used to describe things that are specifically very real. And the reason that we have that particular question mark in this book specifically is because Isaiah is talking about all kinds of crazy stuff. Isaiah is talking about Jesus coming both times. This is 700 plus years before he comes the first time, and he's talking about him coming again, which is nuts because he hasn't even come the first time. And like I've said before, I have no idea how Isaiah organized that in his brain. I don't know if God just told him what to write or if he saw visions and wrote it down, and which is what it says. He saw visions and wrote it down. But how did he understand what he was looking at? You know, because the Jewish scholars for thousands of years did not understand what he was talking about. The Messiah is coming one time, a babe in a manger, one time beaten with stripes for our transgressions, one time tortured, right? Another time as a ruling king, as a conqueror. That's got to be confusing for somebody that reads it and doesn't have, and I mean, we have the benefit of hindsight, right? We've been analyzing this stuff for thousands of years now. We have the benefit of 1,000 books from 1,000 different scholars guiding us along these understandings, right? With the benefit of the Holy Spirit after Pentecost, right? This is before that, right? Way before that. So theoretically, Jesus left, sent the Helper, the Holy Spirit, to come on Pentecost, empowering people and giving them knowledge and understanding and gifts, right? Okay, Isaiah doesn't have that, therefore, in that way at least. So how is he understanding? I don't know. Like I said, I'm going to ask him when I get there. Excuse me, Isaiah, I know you're busy. There's like a line, but can I get a minute? Can I just get a minute? And I just want to know how you understood it. Like, did you understand it, or are you just writing down crazy stuff that God's telling you to write down, right? I don't know. I'm really curious to know. But will there be things as are described? But my point is that is what 11 is. It's a description of the day of the Lord, the rising up of the root of Jesse. It's a description of Jesus. It's a description of assembling the outcasts from around the world. It's a description of touching all the nations. What we have is a specific discussion of the one that will come and save the world. So that is why when we get to chapter 12, that's why I had to do that intro. So when we get to chapter 12, it's a hymn of praise, basically. And unless we know what chapter 11 is talking about, it doesn't make any sense. But since we do know what chapter 11 is talking about, at least ostensibly, right, then we can go chapter 12. In that day, you will say. So we're still in that day. We're still in that future casting, second coming, returning of Jesus, you know, peace and love and perfection of the world, all that. We're still in that day. In that day, you will say, O Lord, I will praise you. Though you are angry with me, your anger is turned away and you comfort me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. For Yahweh, the Lord, is my strength and song. He also has become my salvation. This pieces of that first part have been pulled and used on, you know, t-shirts, bumper stickers, and posters forever. Because if you go through the Bible and you find sections that are inspirational or comforting, and there is a lot of that in Isaiah. Isaiah, like I said, is one of the most quoted books in the Bible. Probably Psalms is the only one quoted more, but I mean, in the modern world, when it comes to having, you know, having a t-shirt or something on your wall to remind you or something above your door, I mean, there is a lot of those passages. And this first section is full of that. It summarizes God, right? It summarizes the story of man and God basically from beginning to end, right? In that day, you will say. Now, fascinating. Who is the you? It's like a little pop quiz. Who is the you? Well, probably Israel, because he's talking to Israel. But that you, at this point, we're far away from like a clear definition of who we're talking about, or talking to. That's been a little while since we've had that clearly defined. And I think that you is a universal you. I think that you is period. Doesn't matter who reads this. The leader of the atheist communist party can pick this up. In that day, you will say. You know, Billy Graham's grandson can pick this up. In that day, you will say. Anybody can pick this up. In that day, you will say, O Lord, I will praise you. And now, if you don't, that's okay. You're going to say, ah, forever. So you got a choice, you know, of what you want to say. But, O Lord, I will praise you. Though you're angry with me, this is why we know that part of that is directed toward Israel. But also, I mean, you can raise your hand if you've never angered God and your whole life's been perfect. But I'm going to put my hand under the table for this one, because we've all done things. Now, I don't know if a description of us angering God is a good description. After Jesus, it doesn't work exactly the same way as the Old Testament. He doesn't tend to lightning bolt people anymore. There's a whole judgment coming to handle all that, right? But turning away from him, making mistakes, not listening to him, not following him, all those things are stuff that we have all done. And now his anger is turned away, and he's comforting them. You comfort me. So that's everyone. Anybody that will listen, anybody that will follow, specifically the Israelites, because that's who he's directly addressing. But it really is everyone. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. That's one of the best passages in the whole Bible. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. For the Lord is my strength and song, and he has also become my salvation. Now, let's talk about that sentence, because I really love the way that's written. The Lord is my strength and song, and has also become my salvation. Now, remembering the beginning of the class, this is the end of time. This is referring to 11, which is referring to Jesus. Strength, song, and salvation. Just think about this. And I don't know if there's a book about this or a song about this. But you have what? You have three descriptive words. For who? God. And what is God? A Trinity. So what do we have? Strength, song, and salvation. Strength, God the Father. Song, in the air. It's a spirit. Holy Spirit. Salvation, Jesus. So God was our strength and song. Then he became our salvation from the cross. In that day is the end. Thousands of years after the cross, right? Which Isaiah knows in the 8th century BC, right? Okay, that's totally nuts, but okay. In that day, at the end of time, in Revelation, at the end of Revelation, in that day, you will say, God was my strength. This is the Jews, right? He said, God was my strength and my song. Now he's also my salvation. So that's Jesus. So whether it's us understanding that God has become our salvation because of Jesus, or it's the Jews at the end of time, everyone is going to know that God is the strength and the song and the salvation. I think that's an awesome description of God. I mean, there's a lot of good descriptions of God throughout the Bible, but your strength, yeah. Your song, yeah. Your salvation. Think about those three words. What do you need from God for most of your life? What have you needed from God? You've needed strength most of your life, giving you the strength to get through things, giving you the strength to live on, giving you the strength to do whatever. The strength. That's the first thing you need. But what do you really get from God once you have all that together, once you have Jesus and God and you're on that path? You get joy. You get a song. You're singing. You're joyous. I can track people, the position they're in as Christians, when they are new Christians, with how much they like the worship music, right? Because you always start off not really liking it. Because you just want to hear the message. You want to get to the analytical facts about why this is good. But later on, you almost want to skip the message because all you want to do is praise and worship because you totally get. So God is filling you with joy. And that's a song. And of course, we're saved. Not only in the end, I want to write a book called Saved, and I probably can't because it's probably been used before, but I had a revelation a few months back about being saved. Not just being saved as I've always thought about it, like being saved for eternal life, being saved period, right? But I thought about being saved daily, being saved in small things, being saved all the time, right? Being saved. You know exactly what I'm talking about. You've been saved recently. You're saved total. So even if you weren't saved recently, you're still saved. Mm-hmm. But you've been saved from a big ordeal recently, right? It's like when you step on the road and the car barely misses you. You just got saved, right? And we've all had things like that happen. So that salvation is small and large. It's near and far. It's today and forever. It's salvation. That's a great description of God functioning in our lives. Strength, song, and salvation. That's basically the summation. There may be other details in your life, but that's a good summation. Now, look, now, in case you thought my relating joy to song was goofy, let's keep reading. Therefore, with joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation. So now the word joy is in play. One of the things I've noticed, joy and peace are these things that God's given me more of as I go. I got knowledge of Him. I got protection from Him. I got strength from Him for decades. But as I go and get older and older, what's happening is I'm getting more joy and peace. And so you're drawing that water, and of course that water is referring to, you know, as we all know, that eternal water that is Jesus, right? And you drink, you know, like he says, you drink this water and you don't, you know, you don't, you're never thirst again, like he told the lady at the well. And of course, we're talking about the lady at the well, and it's Isaiah. Every time I think about how what Isaiah is saying about drawing water from the well and how Jesus hasn't even come yet for it's hundreds of years, like, you know, 700, 800 years later. And he's talking about things that Jesus does and says nonstop when it's 700, 800 years before Jesus even comes, right? That level of prophetic quality is just astounding to me. So now that's what you say. Now you're drawn, therefore, you said that whole thing, and now you're drawing water with joy, right? Now, in that day, you will say, so he has another section. In that day, you will say, praise the Lord, call upon his name, declare his deeds among the peoples, make mention that his name is exalted. Sing to the Lord, for he has done great things or excellent things. And we have songs that say great things, right? You know, we sing that song, Dustin loves that song, where you've done great things. This is known in all the earth. Cry out and shout, O inhabitant of Zion, for great is the Holy One of Israel in your midst. So once again, we're in the end times because the whole earth, all the earth knows this. And that's only going to happen at the end when the whole earth knows the truth of everything, right? So this was a chapter that is a praise chapter because it follows on the heels of the previous chapter, which is describing what it's going to be like at the end with Jesus in charge, with the peace and no more tears and no more pain. Now, this was a short one because it's a hymn of praise, so we can keep rolling tonight. Because what does he do every single time? He gives you praise. He gives you a praise break. Don't worry. Jesus is coming. Everything's okay. Praise God. And then back to the political, geopolitical, sociological situation where the world is totally screwed. So the way that Isaiah approaches it is the way that we live, really. We're in a world that's just full of drama and issues and problems, and we are taking as long and deep of praise breaks as we can because we need as much of God as we can get. But when we go back to work, there's going to be the next thing right on the table. So when we start 13, we're back to dealing with the sin and the problems and the people again. We've had that break where we saw Jesus and we saw the future and we sang a praise, a hymn of praise. Now, 13, the burden against Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amos, saw. So we're going back to straight prophecy now, right? He's got prophetic words. He's got long-term prophecies. He's got good news. Basically, the gospel is in Isaiah, right? But he's also the advisor to kings. He's also dealing with all these political things. And there's multiple kings he's with, multiple people he's talking to, and many, many, many years that he's trying to cover. And he's about to talk about Babylon. Now, the weird thing about that is they don't exist yet, right? Babylon is way down the road. They're the city and some of those ideas are there, but we're having a fight with the north and with Syria, Aram Damascus, currently. After that, the Assyrians are coming to the north, but stopping and not invading the south. Then after that, the Assyrians are invading the south and taking and causing trouble and trying to conquer, but getting rejected because an angel is going to kill their army, right? But the north is going to be in exile. Then after that, Babylon is going to rise and conquer the Assyrians. Then after that, Babylon is going to come into the south and conquer the south and take everybody away, and we'll have Daniel and the lion's den and all that. That is a long time. That's a long time from now in the story, and it's a long time after he dies. And I'd have to do a little more research. I'm not 100% sure if the city and some of the culture already existed. I think it did. I don't think we're talking about hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of years. I think we're just talking about like 100 years. So I think we're going to have Babylon existing, but they're not the great empire they're going to be. Okay? But this is what he sees concerning Babylon. Okay? Which is like four steps away from where he's at. Lift up a banner on the high mountain. Raise your voice to them. Wave your hand that they may enter the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my sanctified ones. I have also called my mighty ones for my anger, those who rejoice in my exaltation. And that is extremely, extremely difficult to understand what he's talking about. So let's keep reading and see if we get more clues. The noise of a multitude in the mountains, like that of many people. This is why I think this is a straight vision, because he's describing it like you would describe a vision. There was like a noise of a multitude in this mountain. It was like that of many people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts musters the army for battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, the Lord and his weapons of indignation to destroy the whole land. Wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will be limp, every man's heart will melt, and they will be afraid. Pangs and sorrows will take hold of them. They will be in pain as a woman in childbirth. They will be amazed at one another. Their faces will be like flames. Behold, the day of the Lord comes. So we have problems, right? We have problems because we're talking about Babylon and we're talking about enemy kingdoms, but we're also talking about the day of the Lord. So we're trying to figure out if he's talking about the end or he's talking about closer in, right? Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he will destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. Now, is that ringing any bells? Because remember, the darkness that covers the sky, and you can't see the stars and the moon and stuff, that's in Revelation. Okay? So what we have is we have this concept of Babylon, which Pastor Todd spoke about. Because Babylon is a place, and it's a kingdom, and it's going to be the ultimate destruction of the current state of affairs and take all these people away. But Babylon is also the description of the enemies of God at the end of time. In Revelation, it's Babylon that falls. right? Now, they're not talking about the city of Babylon. The city of Babylon is barely existing currently. They're not talking about the actual physical city of Babylon falling. They're talking about the concept of Babylon. And what is the concept of Babylon? Well, if you were to go back, you're looking at the non-godly kingdoms developing in the Mesopotamian region. So if you go all the way back to the beginning of everything, humankind, civilization, Eden, all that, if you go all the way back to the beginning of everything, you're going to have the development of the people of God coming out of Eden, etc. But you're also going to have the development of the other people. Now, how that works is up for discussion. Genesis, the first few chapters of Genesis are quite complicated. But the people of God are going to develop, and that's going to be people like Abraham and the eventual Israel, kingdom of Israel, and the patriarchs and all that. But they're going to be surrounded by the kingdoms of the non-people of God, you know. And the origin of those kingdoms is in the Mesopotamian area. And the very first one ever, which Pastor Todd talked about, Nimrod, who may well be an emperor, the very first emperor on the planet, whose name is Sargon the First. That's up for discussion archaeologically and biblically, but Sargon the First / Nimrod, okay, is this king in the very beginning of things, right? And the enemy of God. So these people that are developing these kings. So Babylon is the capital and becomes the metaphorical capital of all of this, of the Assyrians, of the Persians, of the Babylonians, of the Mesopotamian region. So basically, if you want to break it down academically or intellectually, Babylon is the existence of the kingdoms that are against God since the beginning, all the way back. Called Babylon specifically at certain points of time, but that region and those people that we're talking about are the origin, however you want to look at it, whether you want to look at it at Cain or the sons of, you know, Noah, or other people that existed on the planet, you know, however you want to look at it theologically, it's the summation term for the people that are against God. And so that sums up. And if we go forward in time to now, Babylon would be everything in the world, kingdoms, governments, religions, etc., bless you, that oppose God. Now, you can take that as you will. That could be Hindus, that could be Democrats, whatever you want to do with you. I'm not trying to be political. I'm just saying that there is a body of people in the world that follow God and a body of people in the world that do not. And there's some difficulty in the details, but that's the summary. And Babylon is the summation of the governmental, religious, and philosophical entities, as Pastor Todd's has been explaining for weeks. And the fall of that, so we're talking about, at the end of time. Babylon doesn't fall like that, by the way. God, of course, is in charge, but God doesn't, you know, Jesus doesn't come down and conquer the Babylon the first time. That's, Babylon is taken over by the Persians, and then, you know, the leader of the Persians decides to send the Jews back home. God's in charge, but it's not that kind of deal where, like it is in Revelation. So when you start reading things like 13:11, I will punish the world for its evil, it doesn't sound like we're talking about a temporary man battle that's about to happen. It sounds like we're talking about the end. But as we've already said throughout Isaiah, we can be talking about more than one. We can be talking about Babylon near and Babylon far, because Isaiah is everywhere. His head is from the beginning to the end, as far as I can tell. He's having visions of the beginning and the end and everything in between. So we can track that, and that's pretty hard to get your head around. But I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud. I will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I will make a mortal more rare than fine gold, a man more than the golden wedge of Ophir. Therefore, I will shake the heavens. So he's trying to say that there's going to be so many people that are going to be destroyed or killed that it's going to be extremely hard to find them. It's interesting to me the way that's phrased. As you know, I get a little crazy sometimes, okay, with the descriptions of things. But think about this. I will make a mortal, not a human. He didn't say I'll make a human being. He didn't say I will make a follower of me or an enemy of me. He didn't say that. He said, I'll make a mortal more rare than fine gold. So I'm going to make it where mortals are really rare. When are mortals, because we're all mortals, right? What happens to us later?
We die.
And then after that, we don't die, right? After that, we're immortal. So we're eternal, immortal, saved beings, right? We're just sitting here currently being fairly mortal right now. But at the end of time, what's going to be hard to find? After Revelation, after all the Christians and all the saints from the tribulation and everyone else that's judged at the white throne, everybody is going to be in the new heaven, the new Jerusalem. Everybody's going to be immortal. And what's going to be hard to find? A mortal.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody left that was mortal that said, I'll take a pass on God is in the pit, right? It's going to be almost impossible to find a mortal at the end. We're all going to be there, but we're not going to be mortal, right? And the people that are not going to be there, they're not going to be mortal either. They're going to be on the other side, eternally damned, right? And the angels and the other guys flying around in the universe, those guys are not mortal. So it's going to be really hard. So this has to be, in a way, the end that he's talking about. Because that's the only time on the planet when it's going to be hard to find a mortal. More rare than fine gold. So it's good.
Well, apparently there's still a few left.
Right. There's some, there's a gate and bad people are not to come in. Where did that bad guy, how did that bad guy live through all that, by the way? He's like, I'm going to take a pass on the judgment. I'm just going to hang out over here in a cave. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. How is there anybody left? I don't know. But who knows? But some kind of exchange is happening when heaven is in existence. I don't know what it's, I mean, like I said, we'll cover that when we're there. We'll go up the wall and say, oh, there you go. I see. Okay. Therefore, I will shake the heavens and the earth will move out of her place. Now, this is definitely Revelation type stuff here. I will shake the heavens. The earth will move out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts. And in the day of his fierce anger, it shall be as the hunted gazelle and as a sheep that no man takes up. Every man will turn to his own people. Everyone will flee his own land, to his own land. Everyone who is found will be thrust through, and everyone who is captured will fall by the sword. This is not pleasant. This is definitely tribulation talk, right? Their children will also be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Man, let's take a skip on that. I do not want to see that. Their houses will be plundered and their wives ravished. Now, obviously, there's two sets of battles in Revelation. This could refer to either one. But unfortunately, this also refers to when Babylon comes and conquers. Because the conquering of the kingdom of Israel, which has existed for a long time, and I'm talking about specifically at that point in time, Judah, the southern half of the kingdom. The conquering of these kingdoms by Assyria and Babylon are not pretty. These ancient rulers, these ancient leaders that are so powerful and famous, like Shalmaneser or Genghis Khan or whoever, these people are no joke. And one of the things that ancient conquerors did was make things extra horrible because it would make people fold before they fought. When Alexander the Great rolled into Egypt, they just gave it to him. They didn't even fight, because they've heard all the stories about what happens if you fight him. These other guys threw his emissary off their walls trying to be a smarty pants, and that did not go well. He killed everything in that city. I'm talking about everything. I'm talking about plants, houseflies, kitty cats, everything. He literally killed every single living thing in that city because he sent an emissary to them. I don't know if you know this story, but there's an island right off the coast and you can't really get there. So they think they're invincible. They got a giant fortress on an island and he's coming through. He sends an emissary. Hey, I'm Alexander the Great. I'm taking over the world. Get with the program. You can still rule your stuff. It's all good. And they threw his messenger off their walls. So he's like, okay, y'all want to do it like this? We can do it like this. And they're like, you can't. There's no way to get there. He's like, yeah, there is. We're just going to build a bridge. So they start busting up rocks and piling rocks in the ocean until they built the whole bridge right through the sea. It's like, you got enough manpower and not enough people. And they're like, as the land is growing toward them, they're like, can we take a mulligan on our answer? It's too late. And they killed every single living thing in that city. So people would do horrifying things. Genghis Khan was really good at this. He would do some severely horrifying things, which we can't even discuss here. And it was just to scare the crap out of everybody. We do not want that to happen to us. So we're going to give up before we even fight. So when they say anybody who is found is thrust through with a spear, right, or a sword, everyone's captured, is killed, children are dashed in front of their eyes, houses plundered, wives ravaged, totally, absolutely realistic and so scary. People do that. Heck, we've even done that. By we, I mean, you should probably read about Wounded Knee because bad things have happened recently like that. Trying to make a point. If you're outnumbered, that's the case of, you know, the U.S. cavalry in Indian Wars, right? If you're outnumbered in an enemy territory, if you can make a point that's scary enough to scare everybody off, you would do that, right? So this horrific stuff has existed for all of mankind, right? And so that's true of the battles that are in Revelation. It's also true of the battles to come from both Assyrians and Babylon. And now, does anybody remember what replaced the Babylonians? Anybody remember what replaced the Babylonians?
The Greeks.
Nope. The Greeks are after the Medes and Persians. So it's Assyrians, Babylonians, Medes and Persians, Persian Empire, and then Alexander crushes the Persian Empire and its Hellenization, right? What is this? I can't even believe that this says this, because I'm pretty sure this hasn't even been dreamed up yet. But 13:17, behold, I will stir up the Medes against them. The Medes. No one's even heard of the Medes. They're not a thing. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them. So you can see why people thought that they weren't full-on hardcore believers, as Radiant doctrine says, passionate followers of Jesus Christ, right? That are here to shake up the world, right? Passionate followers, hardcore believers, can see miracles and they know that things like this are possible. But you can see how someone who wasn't that way, even if they were a professor at a seminary, you can see how they would think this has to be written after Isaiah. They're talking about Babylonians and Medes. Right? But that's exactly what happened. The Babylonians took over. All that really bad stuff happened. Why is it described from the point of reference of God? Because God let it happen because his people had turned their back on them. It's like, okay, we're going to have to, you know, we're going to have to cull the herd. If you guys are going to act like this, I'm going to let the Babylonians come. If everybody would have got on the right path, everybody would have fallen on their knees in front of God and begged, then the Persians, you know, the Babylonians would have never made it that far. But they didn't, and so there they were. But what happened historically to the Babylonians? They're taken over by the Medes and Persians. And here it is. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, who will not regard silver. And as for gold, they will not delight in it.
Also, their bows will dash the young men to pieces, and they will have no pity on the fruit of the womb. Their eye will not spare children, and Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It would never be inhabited. Yikes. So now we're on the step past Babylon. So where we're sitting in time, we're before the Assyrians. Assyrians are coming, okay? After the Assyrians, Babylonians. After the Babylonians, Medes and Persians, okay? So we haven't even seen the Babylonian Empire yet, which is where, you know, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will be living and stuff like that. What does it mean about not regarding silver and gold and not delighting in it? These guys are about the expansion of the empire. They're about power. The gold is okay, the silver is okay, but that's not the point. The point is to conquer and destroy and be the king of everything, right? And by the way, what does it mean about their bows dashing young men to pieces? They have a new technology level. So we're talking about the Persian Empire. Persian Empire developed a lot of new technology. Remember, I don't know if you ever saw the movie 300. It's a ridiculous, I love it, but it's not like, you know, historically accurate movie. But in the movie 300, the Persians are attacking at Thermopylae, and Leonidas and the 300 Spartans are defending. And you see all this stuff, like, you know, you see elephants, for instance, and you see these guys throwing these bombs that explode like grenades. And the point of all that is, you see guys that have katanas and stuff. So the Persians are going to go far enough to the east that they're going to encounter the technology of China and India. So they're bringing that back to the Middle East from the Far East. And one of those things that they have is the ability to do things like Asian lacquered construction on bows, which is a compound lacquered construction, which makes a much more powerful bow. And of course, this is 1,000 years probably before that, well, a couple hundred years at least before that even exists, right? But the technology is mentioned here, which is higher for the Persians. Their anger, their disregard for, you know, wealth over conquering. And we get a reference that's tying us back to Abraham. The beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, that is Ur of the Chaldees. That's where Abraham is from. That is where it all started, and that is in the southern part of the Mesopotamian, you know, river delta. The Tigris, Euphrates rivers make this whole area called Mesopotamia, and that is the area that we're talking about all these kingdoms coming out of. And in that area is where Ur was. And in that area, that's where Abraham came from. And then not far from there is where we had things like the Tower of Babel, okay? And then as he gets over into the Holy Land and we go sideways, we get to Sodom and Gomorrah, which are completely annihilated, right? And no one can live there ever again. And that's what it says here. It talks about that happening to Babylon because the Medes and Persians. It would be, so it will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation, nor will the Arabian pitch tents here. So what is Arabian? Now we're on the people after the Babylonians, after the Medes and Persians, after the Greeks. So we don't start calling people from that area Arabs until relatively recently in this massive time frame. So now we're talking about Arab peoples, Arabian peoples, which don't even exist yet. He might as well have said, and then we'll fight Muhammad. And of course, the whole world would be on fire right now if it said that. But it's close to that. Generation to generation. So this thing's going forever. I mean, he's covering kingdoms and empires after kingdoms and empires after kingdoms and empires. Now, the thing is, we know And I just want to get academic for a second. If he wrote it after Arab was a common term for people of that region, after the Persians had passed away, Medes and Persians had passed away, if this was written at that point in time, we would know. We would know because the Hebrew would be a more modern, closer to zero Hebrew. It wouldn't be an ancient Hebrew of his time that this was written in. But we have copies of this from the BCs. So we know that this is not written, you know, 400 years later after Isaiah died. We know that this is written roughly around, of course, there's lots of flexibility. It's very strange and very difficult with all the dates and all the language and everything. Obviously, anything BC is hard, right? Anything before the Greeks and Romans organized the world, that section of the world, it's difficult to track, right? But it is very clear here that we're talking about hundreds of years of time. And we're talking about the future all the way to the end, in fact. But Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, he's calling Babylon the glory of kingdoms, and it's not even a kingdom yet. So there are no Arabian pitch tents there. I mean, I need to figure out exactly when that term became popular, because it's definitely not back here, but yeah. Okay. Arabians bringing flocks. There's no Arabian pitch tents there, that's for sure. Nor will shepherds make their sheepfolds there, but the wild beasts of the deserts will lie there, and their house will be full of owls. Ostriches will dwell there? Are there ostriches? Are they coming from really far away? I think there are ostriches. Like I said, these terms that are being used are fascinating. They're fascinating. Ostriches are dwelling there. Wild goats will caper. Their hyenas will howl in their citadels. Jackals in their pleasant palaces. Her time is near to come. Her days will not be prolonged. Now, the last piece of the discussion for all this craziness tonight, the last piece of the discussion is the shift in gender. You're talking about kingdoms, you're talking about Babylon, you're talking about young men being dashed to pieces in Arabian pitch tents. You're talking about all this stuff, okay? The way this chapter ends, her time is near to come. Her days will not be prolonged. We are now in Isaiah chapter 13, referring to Babylon as a her, which is exactly what we see in Revelation. Babylon isn't even a thing yet. But according to Isaiah, Babylon is the glory of kingdoms, which it was. Babylon was the glory of kingdoms. Babylon had the hanging gardens. Babylon had some of the wonders of the ancient world. Babylon was one of the most powerful kingdoms of the ancient world. And there's going to be hyenas and jackals wandering around through that world that was, or is, or whatever you want to call it, Babylon, right? So, I mean, this is a long period of time. There is a city, ancient Babylon, its ruins. Built on top of it is a newer city of Babylon. And Saddam Hussein initiated a program to try to rebuild the ancient capital of Babylon. He didn't get, you know, he didn't live long enough to do all that. But I mean, think about that in modern terms. Just think about that for a second. Saddam Hussein is trying to rebuild. So what does Saddam represent? Saddam represents basically all the enemies of God, right? So Saddam represents murder and, you know, genocide and torture and greed and lust and all the bad things of the world. Saddam Hussein and his sons represent it, right? And they built this empire, you know, their empire, this, you know, modern Babylon. And he tried to actually rebuild the actual Babylon. So, I mean, this stuff that we're talking about is existing all the way here. So, if we know, you know, okay, so take for instance, we were talking about the word Arab and when it became popular. We know that it existed, you know, 8th and 9th century BC, that word existed. But he's using all these bizarre terms that don't really equate to the language he's speaking. Am I making sense? He's referring to all these things, that don't exist yet, or at least the way that he understands them, the way he's expressing them, don't exist in this way. So, I mean, Arab peoples are, you know, technically an ethnic group, but now it's larger than that. And it's expanded by, like I said, we talked expanded by Muhammad, and it becomes part of Islam. That whole thing is interconnected. I don't know if he's talking about Arab traders at the time, that little people group, or if he's talking about something more far-flung than that, which is very possible, you know, because he's talking about Babylonians and Medes and all that stuff. And if he was talking about Arabs in the way that we understood it after Muhammad, then we are in a position where we're talking about all these stages of time. And we could, because that's going to be the next kingdom. So, after, you know, Greece and Rome, we get back to, you know, our sort of Islamic kingdoms and empires that exist in that part of the world. And I don't know if that's what that means or not. You know, could be something. But when he's talking about Medes and Babylonians, to throw that word in there is odd, because it wouldn't be talking about peasant guys. Probably it could be, because he talks about their pitch tents. But anyway, I mean, this is a deep and difficult discussion, and we made it through two chapters tonight, which is unusual, because we dealt with the praise over the far future, and then we reeled it back in. And the way I read this literarily, you know, linguistically, the way I read this is like, here's the end of time, here's Jesus, here's the new kingdom, the new Jerusalem and the new heaven. This is what it looks like. Praise for that. Now, here's sort of how we're going to get there. We're going to go through the downfall of this and the downfall of that and the downfall of this and the downfall of that, and we're going to get there. But we're going to go through nothing but like drama between now and then, you know, and it's painful, you know, but he says the day of the Lord is at hand. And then lift up a banner. The way it started was lift up a banner on the high mountain and raise your voice to them. Wave your hand that you may enter the gates of the noble. So he's talking about the kingdoms, right? He's also talking about the multitude in the mountains. And that's fascinating, because we talk about Zion and Mount Zion, and the multitude in the mountains could refer to the people of God. That tumultuous noise of the kingdoms and nations gathered together could be, remember when Jesus is coming back with the army? Right. He's coming back with all the people that are with him. And that's there's a mountain, there's Zion, and there's all these kingdoms and nations gathered together. And that tumultuous noise, it talks about that in Revelation. So we could really be dealing over and over again with a parallel text from Isaiah to Revelation, which would be 800 chronological years and several thousand real years, right? Because it's about 800 or so, a little bit more, till Revelation is written down by John. But it's thousands of years between here and the actual end of time. But there's so many things about what he's writing that are parallel to Revelation. You could almost write them side by side in some of the pieces of it. It is almost side by side. And it was like that before on the good side. Now it's like that on the bad side, on the tribulation side and the battles and the army side. So there's a lot of density to that. But there's all these crossovers you could draw, and you could spend time doing that. The Lord of Hosts is mustering the army for battle. That seems to be that battle of Armageddon or whatever, right? They come from far countries and from the end of heaven. So that's crazy. That's cool. It refers to the weapons of indignation in 13:5. The Lord and his weapons of indignation. Do you remember what it describes the weapon as when Christ comes back with the armies on his horse? It says the sword of his mouth. So he's got a sword coming out of his mouth, right? So it's words, or it's his words that are the weapons. And weapons of indignation doesn't make sense unless you put it in context with that. Because what's a weapon of indignation? Indignation is you being upset about something, right? You're offended and upset. You're speaking out. Weapons of indignation aren't machine guns. Weapons of indignation are words, because you're offended. And that's exactly what is happening when the Battle of Armageddon or the end of time happens. His weapon of indignation, that could very well be the same thing as the sword coming out of his mouth from Revelation. So, I mean, there's so many wail for the day of the Lord's come. We talk about in Revelation about everybody crying and wailing, right, hiding in caves. I mean, so there's all these things that you can draw, you know. And, of course, there's a woman in childbirth here, just like there is in Revelation. Okay. Faces like flames. Could be faces in flames. That'd be bad. Could be flaming eyes, referring to Jesus is described as having eyes of flame when he comes back. So, I mean, you could just pull out word after word after word that's a cross-referencing the stars not being seen, the darkening of the sky. And you could just pull out example after example after example of the Revelation. So for me, that's just, I mean, as it has been the whole time, it's just sort of astounding how many cross references there are. And we have definitive understanding of this text in BC. And it just seems impossible that it exists with all this knowledge of all these things. Way before, you know, Revelation, way before Jesus is here, way before all this stuff, we know that this exists way before all of that. So, to me, it's just, you'd have to spend time with it, but it's just such a revelation, if you will, of the depth of continuity and solidarity in the Bible. you know, the way that John is writing and presenting everything is not, it's not reminiscent of Isaiah. It's not like he's reminiscing about Isaiah. His stuff is all completely different and much more different the way it's written, much more modern at the time, right? Written in Greek. I mean, everything about it is different. But there is this complete cross-reference happening. There's so many things in there to unpack. We could talk about gold of Ophir. I mean, we could talk about this, like, all these things. That is that's from First Chronicles, 3,000 talents of gold of the gold of Ophir. Ophir is like an area, like it's referring to like the treasure of Solomon's temple, which is also related to the Arab Peninsula. I mean, it's just so gigantic and worldly. It's like, I guess my point is, it's so much bigger than Isaiah. Does that make sense? All the things he's describing are just so beyond the scope of his daily life. Like it has to be God. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
He's just talking about way too many things, some of which don't even exist. And I'm very curious about, what was the animal I was asking about? Ostriches. There's owls and ostriches in there. Shaggy goats. I'm assuming ostriches exist. I don't know. I was asking that question a long time ago about the range of ostriches. When we were doing Genesis, we discovered some really cool stuff about camels. Remember camels? Because when we were doing Genesis, you know, it talks about him taking these camels, and when we cross-referenced with the lineage, with the time frames, camels were just barely, like, didn't even exist in that region yet. So it's almost like he was bringing this amazing creature as this, like, almost like a present or whatever. And it was just, it would have been shocking to the place he was going. In Egypt, they had him, but where he was going would have been shocking. And it was just one of those little like details that just enriches.
I always thought
ostriches. Yeah, and so they would have come up there, and I know the ostriches are running around Australia. But they are in Africa, and I think there's probably two different kinds. I know they don't fly, so I'm not 100% sure, clear on how they're in these different places. But yeah, since ostriches, you know, are existing in Africa, ostriches getting up there to where we are. So let's just finish with that, because there's so many crazy things in this. But let's imagine that the range of ostriches is down in Africa. And over in Australia, and they don't exist in the Middle East, right? Let's just imagine that. And they would probably be hindered in their movement from Africa to the Middle East by the deserts they would have to go through, right? And I know that they're in Africa, but the problem is, why would they be described in this area, right?
Yeah.
So,
Queen of Sheba.
Right, so this time is a long time ago, but here's what's way before it for a long time, and that's Egypt. So Egypt is in power by roughly 3000 BC, roughly, and empowered all the way up until after Isaiah, right? They're in power, well, they still exist. They still exist. But the pharaohs, you know, are going to be replaced by Hellenistic pharaohs with the Ptolemies. Then you're going to have the whole you know, Mark Antony and Cleopatra thing and, you know, all that. So, but Egypt has been around for a very, very long time. And so bringing creatures up from Africa into the courts was a very common practice, bringing presents to the pharaohs. And we have gazelles in here too, by the way. So bringing gazelle, bringing ostriches, bringing all those things down from Africa and bringing them up. Now, here's my question for the final question of the evening. If we're talking about Mesopotamia, where Babylon is, and the attack coming from Babylon over into the area of Jerusalem, which is an attack from the east to the west and far away from Egypt, why are we talking about gazelles and ostriches? Does that make sense? Does my question make sense? So we can be fairly clear that there's not going to be so many ostriches running around when the Babylonians arrive in Jerusalem that that's a thing worth noticing, or gazelle, right? And I think that the answer to that question is more hints at the universality of what we're talking about, right? We're talking about one thing, which is Babylon invading and destroying and causing all this trouble. But we're talking about another thing, and that is the battle at the end of time. And the battle at the end of time, we get some hints, such as the stars and constellations not being visible, right? But we get some hints. Shaking the heavens, the earth moving out of its place, the day of his fierce anger, hunted gazelle, right? So we're talking about their houses being full of owls. Ostriches will dwell there. So just think about this. We're talking about the Middle East. We're talking about the area of Jerusalem. And then we're talking about the destruction of everything there. Wild goats, hyenas, jackals, owls, ostriches. There's a whole lot of animals named, most of which are not there. So to me, that is backing up the concept of the earth being shaken, right? Of there being a complete, like, everything being messed up. Their houses being full of owls, ostriches dwelling there, wild goats there, hyenas howling in their citadels, jackals in their pleasant places, because that's what it says right before her time is near to come, her days will not be prolonged. Which is fascinating, because that is the same way in which Babylon is referred to in Revelation. So, if you had mass destruction of everything, right, and rivers dried up, and people destroyed by the millions at the end of time, it's mass problems. What would do very well? What thing on this planet would do very well in the tribulation? And the answer is scavengers. Scavengers are going to do really well. They might do so well that jackals and hyenas could come up and change their ranges and come up out of Africa all the way to Jerusalem, because there's so much food everywhere and so few rivers in their way, right? Everything gets dried up. Everything gets completely jacked in the tribulation. So I think that the scavenger birds and creatures of the world, the packs of wild dogs, hyenas, jackals, etc., because it says, it's specifically taught, of course, we got some weird things in there, like owls and wild goats, and ostriches aren't known to pack up and go, you know, and go kill refugees, but whatever, okay? The fact is that that would change the ranges on things. It would change the way the world is organized in a way. not to mention weather. What happens to the deserts? What happens to the forests? What happens to the temperatures, right? I mean, there's going to be a shakeup in the tribulation time. It could change the weather completely. It could drive animals completely out of where they normally would be. But the image here, and this is how I'll finish, the image here is desolation. The image here is that the land of the people, the cities, the kingdoms, the castles are desolate. Just symbolically, think about a great capital city with a great palace and all the beautiful parades and all the horses and all the wonderful flags and all the people, the merchants doing business and the markets with all the tents. Think about a big, beautiful, tremendous, think about Camelot. Think about a big, beautiful, fabulous city with a big, beautiful, fabulous citadel, and then bring that into the end times and have it completely desolated, and the majority of people just disappear, and everyone else just is running, hiding in caves, and there's utter chaos, and there's wild dogs running the streets. There's hyenas howling in the citadel, and that's the image. The image is the destruction of all the power base of man, which, as Pastor Todd has just pointed out recently, is Babylon, which is the her referred to in the last two sentences of this. So, once again, Isaiah has taken us from his time all the way to the end of time. And once again, I got questions, but we're out of time for tonight. But that is, to read the words Medes and the words Babylon and all those other things there, is just to understand how crazy this whole thing is. I'm not saying that those places don't exist at that time, but to have him referring to those things as great kingdoms when they haven't even come into power yet is very strange, you know. For instance, the Medes, they're in Media, they're Iranians today, and they have an extensive empire during the 7th century, which is the next century after this. So they don't even have an empire yet. And then they're going to be fused with or conquered by the Persians, and that's when we have Cyrus the Great, who is the one who sends, he's the one who unites the Medes and Persians. He's also the one who sends the people of, you know, the Hebrews back to the Holy Land to rebuild. And that is 500 and something BC. That's a couple hundred years minimum after this. So anyway, I just really love that whole thing. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for going through. Now, hey, we went through 12 and 13. So next week, don't forget, it's Fusion. Mm-hmm. And the week after that, we will be here, which is, what is that? The 11th? 11th. So the 11th, we're here. Then we have 2 weeks or 3 weeks off because I'm gone from 17 to 20-something August. We're going to Hawaii. So after we get this school set up and the new system stabilized, and Bobby can figure out what he's teaching those classes, and we'll go to Hawaii. I haven't been on a trip like that for quite a few years now. Mm-hmm. But then by the time I get back, it'll be the end of August. And then of course we'll have the Fusion on the first Wednesday of September. So we're going to have the 11th, and then we're going to be back after Fusion in September. All right. So that's going to be the break. And so that'll, so we'll have a little bit of a break there, but then once we're back, we're, We're headed, you know, what do we got? How many chapters left? We got 50 chapters left or something like that. We're only 50 weeks away from being done at that point, huh? 66, yep, we just finished. So we got, you know, a little bit over 50 left. All right, does anybody have any last comments or questions about all that? Thanks for putting up with all the crazy, because there's a lot packed in Isaiah.
These were two incredible chapters.
He packs it in. All right, let's pray. Lord, once again, we just open our hearts and minds to you and thank you so much from the bottom of our hearts for all this wonderful things you do, that this place, the word, the people here, just the ability to do this, to study your word, to come together in a community like this and to talk about all these things. It's just so amazing to us. We're so grateful for this place, for this church, for everyone here, and the ability to do this. Thank you for bringing Burl back to us safely. Protect everyone's health here. Protect their families and their travels. Keep everyone safe. Thank you so much for the chance to study your word. Have your word open our eyes and touch our hearts and our minds, and just keep growing within us, within our hearts and minds, and keeping us, you know, on the path that you've designed for us, and coming closer and closer to you all the time to have more to do with us. Protect everyone here when it comes to their homes, their families, their health, their finances, the companies, every person here, the people that aren't with us that are here a lot, everyone in our circles, just protect and draw them closer and closer to you. We're so grateful for this time. Bring us back safely again for the next meeting, and keep this, your word and your truth growing in our hearts every day. We love you so much, and we pray all these things in the mighty and unstoppable name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Woohoo!
Thank you, Victor.